This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, and welcome to this bonus episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Maren Meinhardt, and I'm joined today by Daniel Kehlmann, one of Germany's most successful and highly acclaimed novelists. Daniel is here today to talk about his novel, Till, which is going to be reviewed in a forthcoming issue of the TLS. Till is a wonderful novel in which the jester Till Eulenspiegel is imported from the Middle Ages and transplanted into the Thirty Years' War. So first of all, I was wondering, what is behind your decision to take Till out of the Middle Ages and plop him into the 17th century?
Yes, that didn't seem like a very daring decision to me when I made it, although it might have been, but that's not what it seemed like to me. I wanted to write about that time period, about early modernity, about the wars of religion, about the 30 Years' War, and I was looking for some kind of guiding character, some character who would lead the reader through this world to different places, mm-hmm. to different people. And there's not a great many character types or professions or kind of people who can do that for you in early modernity, because people didn't really travel. And also the social structure was very rigid. So a noble man or noble woman didn't meet a peasant, or people who lived in a city did not meet a cleric from the countryside. So it was all people were not moving in any socially or in space. But of course, there were vagrants, people who didn't belong anywhere, who were traveling. And the mm-hmm. most interesting kind of vagrants were, of course, jesters. So it made sense, because jesters are always interesting anyway, to use a jester as a guiding character who could go to all kinds of places, perform in front of all kinds of people, from people who were high in society or low in society. And then I thought, why not take the great mythical German jester himself, Till Eulenspiegel, whom every German knows. Many of us, including me, knew him through children's books, but still he's kind of a mythical character in German folklore and in German culture. And I thought, why not just take him? And it seemed the fact that the anecdotes are 200 years older than the period my novel is set in, that didn't seem like such a stretch to me, because he was not a real character. It's not like as if I had moved, I don't know, Voltaire or some king of England to a different time. So I just moved a character from anecdotes and folk stories, and the world hadn't changed that much. So it's not, if you would time travel from our time, 200 years into the past, you would find a very different world. But if you time travel from 1600 to 1400 in a village, the village wouldn't have looked much different.
Yeah, that's a fascinating idea. And the whole idea of the 30 Years' War being such a fascinating different time is also something it's quite hard to get your head around. I think at one point some character in the book explains that during the war, towards the end of the war, there were people around who didn't even know what it felt like if there wasn't war, mm-hmm. who hadn't known peace, which is...
Because it took 30 years. That's a whole generation.
Yes.
And of course, that doesn't mean that there was fighting all the time everywhere. But the war was felt everywhere in northern and middle Europe. And some regions were less affected by it. Some regions in Bavaria, for example, or also in parts of the Netherlands, it was really devastating to an extent that is hard to imagine. Half the population died. Other regions were just affected for a short period of time, and then it was over for them. But it was, if you look at Europe as a kind of a self-contained world, which in many ways it was back then it was like, for Europeans, it was like a world war.
Mm-hmm. So this idea of the past feeling very different, if we were sort of flung into the world of the 30 Years' War now, how, I mean, I noticed that you said at some point that there, you know, that you couldn't drink the water, so people walked around. That was, do you want to tell that one?
Yeah, that's something that I always found fascinating. It's kind of a trivia, but not a information, but it's not a trivial thing, that it was close to impossible to get your hands on or into unpolluted water. Most wells would have been, because animals drank from it, it would have been not fit for human consumption, and people knew that. So people drank milk or diluted beer, and in a way, that's something that, of course, a historian can only speculate about. Mm. But as a novelist, you are allowed to invent,
of course,
on the basis of what you know. So knowing that, I would, as a novelist, I love then to imagine a world where most people would be a little bit drunk all the time.
And that, of course, changes the whole feel.
Of course, of course.
So that also makes you think, of course, I mean, if you know that, I mean, there might be other sort of unknowns that we don't even know about.
Yes. I mean, it's fascinating how much we don't know about, especially about daily life of regular people. That is a field that historians have become interested in only about 30, 40 years ago. Before that, historians were only looking at kings and queens and their marriages and battles between them, and not what the life of a peasant or a miller actually looked like. And it's still fascinating. I was trying to get these things right. So when I say a novelist is allowed to invent things, that's certainly true. But also part of the fun of writing and reading historical fiction is that especially small details that the writer should try to get them right, if possible, if at all possible. But there are many things we really don't know much about. And there I felt allowed to invent. So I give you one example. We know that before the 18th century, child mortality rate was incredibly high. So most children died before they were 5 years old. Once your child made it past five, you had a good chance that child would see adulthood. But I think 2 out of 3 children died before they were five. So in many ways, that must have affected to a very deep degree how parents related to their children, because you had a baby, but you could not really allow yourself to love that baby too much, because you felt like this baby will be gone very soon. And that's what happened usually.
Most of them, yeah.
So historians are very careful about this, and rightly so. Historians, especially Philippe Ariès, who wrote the greatest book ever on the history of childhood, he's very, very careful. He says, we don't really know what that means for the emotional life of people. We can only speculate, but I don't want to speculate too much. But I can do that. I'm a novelist. So on the basis of what I believe to be true, which is that in many ways, relationships between parents and their children were much colder and less loving than they are today. I believe that, although it's something that's hard to prove for historians. You can only speculate about it. But on that basis, I feel like I'm allowed then to invent something about how parents and children relate to each other, and invent scenes between, for example, Till and his parents. And but I do that because I believe it to be true.
No, that's hard to imagine. Yes, so we did quite a lot of research into witch trials, which is also a big feature of that period.
You could say did a lot of research. There was, in a way, is that to it was more obsessive than that. So I started, it started out as research because I wanted a witch trial in the novel. And I had a whole year of researching or reading where I fell into that rabbit hole. So it's, for me, the most disturbing thing that happened in European history before the 20th century is the witch craze. The utter, complete hysteria that went into those trials against about 100,000 innocent people who were tortured and killed as witches.
In what time period, roughly?
Well, it started. It's not a medieval thing. We often like to think it's a medieval thing, and then we got over it. But actually, it happened. It started at the end of the Middle Ages, and became worse and worse in early modernity. And the time period I'm setting my novel in, the 30th War, it peaked shortly before the 30th War and had it another peak afterwards. And then it slowly subsided and became less crazy. And then it just, like often with hysteria and mass hysteria, people then just seem to have forgotten about it. It just seemed to disappear out of their minds. But it's an utterly disturbing part of European history, because it happened, not, as I said, not in the Middle Ages. It was not something that the church was actually promoting actively. It was fascinating enough. It was something that the church then acted on, of course. They're not innocent. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But in many places, in many parts of Europe, the church actually tried to put a lid on it. But people were in frantic fear of their neighbors. Everyone was in frantic fear that their neighbors would be witches and could be cursing them. And and of course, the thing that's so hard to understand for us is that those people accused of being witches, more and more women, and beginning more men, then it were more and more women, they were tortured in the most terrible way.
Exactly. In your book, you make that quite clear how absurd that is. Why were people so keen to go with that?
The crazy thing, from our perspective, the insane thing is, we know that the torture is, to put it very bluntly, an effective way to get information, but a very bad way to get honesty. So how could they believe that a confession that you got out of a person who was tortured, that was a valid confession? And it's one of those very strange things that makes you also think about the things we believe to be valid and true.
Absolutely, yes.
Because no one doubted that. No one raised that issue. But we are torturing these people, so of course they're going to confess. It seemed people treated those confessions as valid and took them as proof that there are witches everywhere. And it's very easy to just feel superior to the people back then, but I think that's not a good position. The right thing to ask is, are there any things that we take for granted that we should really not take for granted, that we should think more profound or more clearly about?
Are you thinking of anything in particular, or is that a more general?
I mean, I don't want to put these two things on the same level, but I do think, for example, the way we destroy our life with cars is something that would come to mind. Like, I mean, we are all concerned about climate change, of course, and we should be. But 30% of our cities, of 30% of our cities is parking cars. If we would get rid of those cars and plant trees instead, the temperature in the city would be would go down about 5 degrees.
Oh yeah, I couldn't agree more. Yes,
so, and we all feel like cars are just something natural and normal. And if a person would time travel to our world from 150 years ago, they would think it's unbelievable how our cities are, how ugly they are, how unlivable, how hard it is to just cross the street because of those terrible cars everywhere. So I'm not saying cars are the same as torturing witches.
No, absolutely, but it's...
But it's something that we take for granted. And if you start thinking about it, you feel like this is really strange.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I once read that if cars were invented today, you know, they wouldn't even be allowed.
Because no, of course not.
A menace.
They're a terrible idea.
generally, you seem very interested in the pre-Enlightenment world. Are there any other things that interest you other than witch trials? What other aspects?
Well, it was kind of a journey for me to get there. I was always very... I'm a big fan of Enlightenment, of Enlightenment philosophy.
Absolutely, yes.
I love and admire Voltaire and Hume and how these people really were funny, witty, powerful polemicists,
yeah,
for reason and for actually making people's lives better in so many ways. So in a way, I got... But still, on the other hand, I was also lit in terms of literature. Of the things I like to read, I always loved fairy tales. I love ghost stories. I love magic realism also.
Of course, yes.
So in a way, I naturally, I think, had to get interested at some point in what was the world like when people really did believe in magic and,
yes,
in curses and in spirits and ghosts and witches. So when that was not something that we just like to put in stories because it's beautiful and interesting,
yeah,
and gives us kind of a delightful little shudder when we think about it, but when everyone really did believe in that. And of course the answer is the world was pretty terrible. So but it is something that is really interesting, I felt, as a novelist to write about. So in a way, you could say when someone publishes a historical novel or a historical work of fiction of any kind, they always like to talk about how much this is relevant to the time we live in now and how many ways human beings are still pretty much the same. And that is all true. And this is all interesting, but I was really interested in many ways in how different people were 400 years ago, how the world was different, how people had a different way of, mm-hmm, thinking, of relating to each other. So so even though now I'm often asked about the things that are similar between, for example, the 30 Years' War and the war in Syria,
yeah,
and there are many similarities, what I was really interested in terms of psychology and the psychology of the characters is how different they are from us. And I wanted to get into that really different mindset. So I,
yeah,
tried to use a narrative voice that doesn't know more than they do. So so I tried to even to not use... I'm not trying to emulate 17th century language, not at all.
But the way of thinking.
Exactly, I'm following their way of thinking. And so, for example, I'm also in... For example, I'm not even... When you describe events that happen in a story, you usually use words that describe the time, like minutes, an hour later,
waited
for 2 hours. Even that, I'm not doing, because minutes were not part
of the
life of those people.
Life, yes.
If you would meet someone, you would have said, I'm meeting you in the afternoon.
Yes.
And somehow would have found a way to get together. Even hours, they would have known what hours are, of course.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't have been part of how they experience the world. And I try to, in the way I describe what happens, I'm trying to not use concepts that they wouldn't have used.
Ah, yes, that's very inobtrusively done in the novel, I have to say, yes. Would you like to talk a little bit about what I've noticed in many of your books, especially also, obviously, your first book, The Vermessung der Welt, mm-hmm, Measuring the World, your way of refusing the grand man or grand woman view of history and sort of taking people down off their pedestals a bit, or piercing their bubble just a tiny bit and give them a bit of a reality check.
I mean, yeah.
Is that a sort of theme in your
it
novel,
is.
Which
it's
has
not,
sensed and
It
like?
Is. It's something that in a way comes with itself when you're a novelist that likes to use comedy and comic effects. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what comedy, that's what humor always does, taking down...
Yeah.
People that are really grand and majestic. On the other hand, of course, I do really admire many of the people I wrote about. So in Measuring the World, I do both things. I do make a lot of fun of Alexander von Humboldt, who is kind of a comic character in that novel.
Yeah.
But I also do really admire many things about him. His courage,
mm-hmm,
his dedication to science, his dedication to understanding. So I think those two things do not exclude each other. They can go well together, but of course you have to always balance them against each other. With Till, it's a little bit different because the subject matter, it's also in many parts, I hope so, that's what I try to do, a comic novel, but with the subject matter being so dark, there are many moral questions involved that you don't have in a comedy like Measuring the World, in a comic.
Yes.
So, for example, I do make fun in an aggressive way of Gustav Adolf, the King of Sweden, because he was one of the brutal, mm-hmm. powerful people who killed many, many human beings and who kept the war running when it could have been over.
So he's a legitimate target.
Yeah, I don't think he has any... Swedish friends told me no one has ever made fun of Gustav Adolf in Swedish literature. So
I
was very happy to be the first one. But
absolutely,
I think
yes.
he does not... He has no right to be not to be made fun of. Whereas on the other hand, when I'm dealing with poor and destitute people in a war novel who are... who are in many ways the victims of all this, then of course I wouldn't think of or dare making fun of them. There's nothing funny about that. So in a novel like that, you really have to weigh whom to make fun of and where to use comedy and where not to use comedy.
But it's not just about ordinary people that you talk. It's also people who are extraordinary people. Like Till is obviously extraordinary, but he also spots it in Nele that she, you know, she's different. And this little girl, Martha.
Yeah.
So some people are extraordinary. And in a way, we sort of need extraordinary people. But what makes them different? Is it just a need? Is it just them wanting to be different? Or is it something intrinsic? Or what is it about them?
It's a very good question. So I think in the case of Till and Nele and maybe Martha, I mean, she dies early, so we never
She made the wrong choice. That
right, she makes the wrong choice. She should have followed Till instead of staying with her people, right? So I think in their case, it's really the wish and the ability to run away, to leave everything, to leave your village behind you and to become artists. So I did think of Till and Nele then too as artists in a more brutal, more primitive world, which Germany was back then. Not the world, of course, but Germany was much more brutal, primitive place than it was later. London, for example, was not, or Spain. Those were places of high culture, but Germany was really not. And
I suppose Dickens's London also had its moments of...
Oh, yeah, definitely. But it was a place of high culture.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
But with Till, I thought of him as an extraordinary artist, but the art he's doing is much more physical than for example, Shakespeare, who's his contemporary, is doing at the same
time.
You
make that very clear. He's got to practice loads. He falls off the rope all the time. It's not like he's got some innate ability.
No,
he
has to...
seems to want it.
No, there's a beautiful short story by Thomas Mann about what it is like to be an artist, where he says talent is not being able to do something, it's wanting to do something. I fully agree with that. The people who develop, who become very good in something, they are the crazy people who just don't stop practicing. They are not born with an incredible ability, although that happens too, but that's very rare.
Yeah.
But I think that only happens in music and also sometimes in math and in a different field.
Yeah.
But in most other arts, you have to practice a lot, and the talent is just the wish not to stop practicing, because you really like doing that. So that's why I never fully believe artists who claim that they are suffering so much from their art. I mean, some suffering is fine, but also artists really do like what they're doing.
But then that also leads me on. I mean, there's a price to being an artist, isn't there?
Yeah, but there's a price to everything in life. So,
that's a good
point. Yes, there is, but it's still... I don't quite buy into that romantic notion of the artist having to give up part of his soul and things like that. I really think being allowed to be an artist, being able to be an artist, also, I mean, having the opportunities to actually pursue that wish to become an artist, it's an incredible privilege, and anyone who can do that is actually very, very lucky.
So how do you feel about killing off a nice, sympathetic character like little Martha, who I didn't like to see die, which is also something you dealt with in your novel Fame, with the character of Rosalie, who you in the end rescue?
Well, it's not easy until I felt very close to many of the characters, and killing them off, also killing off Till's father, who gets executed, that really was not easy. And but I felt I had to do this. When you write a novel that's set in a war, in times of war, you have to show that war has real consequences and has real victims. And one of the problems in terms of how you write about war is that readers can usually be quite sure they have the protagonists, and they usually live until the end of the book.
Yeah.
So what I'm doing in Till is I introduce this character, Martha, with a few literary devices that kind of signals to readers that she's going to be one of the protagonists,
yeah,
that she's going to be with you now for most parts of the books.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a few signals, and then that's what the reader expects. If they get to know a character early, and the character kind of is still young and is aspiring
to
something,
about being a grandmother, yes.
And then I even give a flash into the future of what will happen once she's a grandmother, and then she very very early, like at the end of the first chapter, even she dies. And that was hard to do, but I felt it was really necessary,
yeah,
to show myself and the reader that when people die, they always take into their death all their promises, all their expectations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You kill when someone gets killed early in life, their future gets killed with them. So the flesh,
the whole world,
and that flash forward. I actually use something that's very unusual in fiction, which is an omniscient narrator who proves to be wrong. So the narrator tells you about her future, but he is wrong. That future gets killed off once she gets killed off.
That's probably why it's so shocking, yes.
And it is supposed to be shocking. It has to be shocking. And then, of course, the whole village Martha is in gets destroyed in war, and all people die.
Yeah.
And I feel this is an important role of literature towards history. The historian, by definition, can only talk about survivors, but the witnesses we have, the witness account we use,
are the ones who got away, yes,
are per definition the accounts by survivors, because they survive to bear witness. And so in literature, you can actually talk about the people by inventing them, who were utterly forgotten. You can reinvent utterly forgotten people, and you can talk about them or even though they were not allowed to live on and bear witness. And so I felt I had really strong feelings about that. That's what I had to do, even though it means I have to shock the reader quite early on in the book by killing Martha.
And it's a novel where Europe is tied quite closely to England, after all, to Britain. The Winter Queen, after all, is the daughter of James the First.
Yes.
So how do you feel that? I mean, the book was obviously written before Brexit, or just about. So how do you feel about, do you have any thoughts about that, about a different conception of Europe?
Oh, it's really frightening and terrible. I mean, I actually finished the novel after Brexit and after Donald Trump came to power in America. So after all those really, really terrible things happened. And I did feel like some of the dark times that I'm writing about are now coming back, not to the full extent, not like the 30 Years' War, but some of that darkness of tribalism, nationalism is kind of an anachronistic word, but tribalism, I think, is the right word. Like, is of course religious fanatism that back then was religious and might become religious again. I felt like this is all coming back, and I think it's a terrible thing. And I think that in a way, when I started my novel, I was really, as I said before, interested in how much everything was different. I started working on this book in 2012 in a very different world. And I really felt like I had some kind of strange, outlandish, more historical interest in a world where all political systems melt down, where you have a complete failure of all political stability. And while I was writing the book, Syria happened, and then And then in Europe, nationalists came to power, and then Brexit, the referendum happened. So in many ways, the world moved. The world I was living in was moving closer towards the book I was writing, which was a very scary and strange experience. But then I told myself I must have in some way anticipated something, because it wasn't pure coincidence that in 2003-04 I was writing a comic novel about two scientists, and then in 2012-13 I was starting a novel about the world melting down. So I must have anticipated something, but I really didn't know that I was anticipating something. I was surprised. I was really surprised myself.
Well, I think it's not the sort of cheerful note you want to end on, but I think that's what we've got to do anyway. So thank you very, very much, Daniel Kielmann. That was lovely.
Thank you very much for having me here.